From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the day after Election Day 2014, Governor Rick Snyder.
It's an honor being reelected governor. I'm excited, and I'm looking forward to just getting back to work.
Congresswoman-elect Debbie Dingell.
I mean, that was the theme of my campaign, that I wasn't going to Washington to fight with people. I was going to Washington to work with people.
Michigan Radio political analyst Jack Lessenberry.
There are now only 11 Democrats in the Michigan State Senate. You could pack them all in a van.
And pollster Bernie Porn of Epic MRA.
After our poll, the Republican Governors Association started running negative ads against Schauer, and I think that blunted the momentum that he had.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside.
It's time to accelerate and go even faster and get more done.
Rick Snyder wins another term as governor, and the GOP almost sweeps the board in statewide races. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, millions and millions of dollars were spent on election 2014. But in the end, not much has changed. This hour, a rundown of election results from across the state and what they mean for you. Let's begin with Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta reporting from Detroit.
This was supposed to be one of the closest governor's races in decades. Many polls showed it neck and neck until the end. But that's not how it shaped up once the votes were counted. Instead, Governor Rick Snyder built up a decisive lead over the course of the evening. In his victory speech, the governor said his reelection is vindication for his administration's business-friendly policies, the state's takeover of Detroit, and for what he says is a less combative style of governing, despite some big controversies in his first term.
It was time for us to recognize a new path. It was time to reinvent Michigan.
This was just Snyder's second election as a candidate, and because of Michigan's term limits, his final race for governor. He says career training will be a priority in his second term as he tries to address an unemployment rate that is moving in a positive direction, but still remains among the highest in the nation.
It's time to accelerate and go even faster and get more done to reinvent our state, to create opportunities for the future.
The rest of the Republican ticket also fared well, including second terms for Attorney General Bill Schuette and Secretary of State Ruth Johnson, and continued majorities in the legislature and on the state Supreme Court. Democrats had hoped to improve their prospects by boosting voter turnout and getting more of their supporters to vote early by absentee ballots. Those voters make Michigan a blue state in presidential elections, but failed to materialize in the 2014 midterms. Democratic nominee Mark Schauer conceded defeat, but said Democrats will continue to challenge Republican dominance in Lansing.
Never give up. When we get knocked down, we get right back up.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
A rare bright spot for Democrats was Congressman Gary Peters' victory in the race to replace the venerable Carl Levin in the U.S. Senate.
And together, we will build a better America, a stronger Michigan, and our best days are yet to come.
But even Peters' victory was tempered by the likelihood that he will be joining the Senate as a member of the minority party as other states delivered the majority to Republicans.
We're going to wake up tomorrow morning, and guess what? Harry Reid is going to be retired. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Republican nominee Terry Lynn Land addressed the GOP election night party early, thanked the volunteers, and then left without ever formally conceding the race, preferring to deal privately with the sting of defeat while other Republicans celebrated. For the Michigan Public Radio Network, I'm Rick Pluta in Detroit.
And joining me now is Zoe Clark, co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Hello, Zoe.
Hello, Cindy.
Well, a seemingly happy GOP in Michigan.
Indeed, in Michigan and across the country, Cindy.
Now, you spoke with the governor very, very early this morning.
I did, very early, and a very happy, happy guy. I started out by asking him, you know, what he thinks these results mean, what he thinks Michigan voters are saying with this election.
It's a confirmation that we've been on the right path with the road to recovery. We need to accelerate that. So it's an honor being reelected governor. I'm excited, and I'm looking forward to just getting back to work.
often when incumbents win another term, there's talk about, you know, a so-called political mandate, that they have some sort of increased power because it's essentially a vote to continue to do what they've been doing. Do you have a political mandate?
Well, I think if you look at it, I wouldn't describe it as about me. If you look, we increased our majorities in both the House and the Senate. So I think we have a strong mandate from the people of Michigan to say, as public servants, we need to deliver even more to them.
So what does that look like now? Let's say the first 100 days of your second term. What is that going to look like?
Yeah, well, first I'd like to wrap up comprehensive transportation funding, and I would hope to do that even this year. But beyond that, I've talked about several things that I think are really important for our future that include such things as career tech education, really increasing the opportunities for the skilled trades. We've got tens of thousands of great open jobs out there, and we can accelerate how fast they get filled because that would be great for Michiganders.
As you mentioned, you are going to continue to have a Republican-led state house, a Republican-led Senate. That has not always been easy, though. You've had to work very hard with your fellow Republicans, let's say, to pass a Medicaid expansion, for example. Like you said, still working on road funding. How concerned are you about fellow Republicans in the new legislative session?
Well, we've had a great partnership. We've gotten a lot done. Again, it's not about partisanship. You have to have a partnership with the other branches of government. So I hope to have a strong one with this one. And I think seeing increased majorities could make that helpful.
It's likely that the state legislature is going to want to continue to push social issues, something that you've said you're not really interested in. You like to keep an eye on the economy. What is that looking like? Are you hearing of social issues that are going to come up? Of course, there's talk about LGBT rights being added to Elliot Larson. Do you have concerns about too much of a social agenda?
Well, again, I think economic issues are still top of mind for our citizens, followed by education issues. On social issues, the one that I think is relevant that I have called for is I would like the legislature to talk about Elliot Larson. Because, again, I think that's a good topic that is hopefully something that will come up either in lame duck or after the first of the year.
I want to talk a minute about the actual campaign. I want to read you a quote from conservative-leaning columnist Nolan Finley this morning, who wrote about you. Quote, he's always insisted effective governing is a substitute for political campaigning and was proved right, although in the process he gave his team ulcers. Did you give your team ulcers over this election?
Well, I don't think I gave them ulcers. Again, this is where I'm not a career politician. And I think there are better ways to do things in our country with respect to how we behave politically. And what do I mean by that is there's too much negative, there's too many attacks, there's a lack of civility and respect. And these are things that we wouldn't put up with in our work life, we wouldn't put up with in our family life. And so I'm trying to be a good role model to say I think there's a better way to do things and expect a higher standard out of people that are public servants and when they go through the process of running for office.
Although there were some Republicans who were saying they were worried that you weren't doing enough, that you weren't campaigning hard enough. Did you ever have that talk with your campaign about if you needed to campaign harder?
No. I mean, I don't think those folk were with me on the bus the last 3 days. Going around the state that may be saying those things. Because, again, it was out campaigning hard because I view that as part of the process, is getting out to talk to citizens. And I always enjoy that. I appreciate that. Town halls I love. I think everyone knows that in terms of it's a great dialogue answering questions from citizens. That's who I work for.
Is there something you learned from this campaign? I mean, you know, as you said, you've crisscrossed the state. You've talked to thousands and thousands of voters. Did anything about that open your eyes or surprise you?
Well, the good part is the issue about staying positive. I mean, I heard that from a lot of people as I traveled the state. A lot of people would come up to me, and regardless of their political background, and say, Governor, we appreciate the fact that you're not blaming anyone. And, you know, you're trying to talk about the issues and solve problems. And that encouraged me to keep on that path because, again, in many cases, people, I think, are fed up with what they saw on TV for many of those ads.
How do you see the Michigan races fitting into this national picture? We've been hearing about this Republican sweep. Of course, Republicans taking over the U.S. Senate. They'll continue to control the State House of Representatives. How do you see your race fitting into that landscape?
Well, again, that's not the main lens I use. It's not about partisanship. It's about better service to people. And so the issue is, and I'll use Washington as an illustration. Washington is all messed up. And I wish they would do more relentless positive action where if you stop and thought about it, what would happen in Washington if they would agree not to blame one another and fight with one another? They'd have time to get a whole lot of work done. And in fact, that's what we did in Michigan, and that allowed us to do some of the key issues they need to do, like balancing the budget, about doing debt repayment, and doing tax reform. Those are all critical topics that, in fact, Michigan's recovery would be faster and faster, and so would the whole nation if Washington did a better job of working together.
Finally, Governor, speaking of D.C., I've got to ask you, your name has been coming up more and more as there is talk about 2016. Can you possibly see yourself running for a higher office?
Well, it's I just got reelected as governor. I'm really proud of that fact. So I'm a happy governor right now in terms of looking at that. The only part that has any value to me is if it helps market Michigan in terms of people looking at Michigan as a success, that's a good thing. But in terms of running for office, I'm honored for the election yesterday.
Governor Rick Snyder saying he is honored for the election yesterday, speaking there to Zoe Clark, who is here in studio with me. But Zoe, very interesting to note, he is not refusing to say no to the idea of something in Washington.
I know, right? And of course, I mean, you know, something us who follow politics a little too closely just have to ask, because, you know, the day after one election, we are already counting down to the next one, 734 days to be exact. Okay. But no, you are right. It is interesting to note he seemed to play a little footsie there with running again, didn't he?
And even in the morning after coverage, I heard VP mentioned. Mm-hmm. I heard cabinet position mentioned.
We will keep an eye on it.
All right. Well, Michigan Radio's co-host of It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark. Thank you so much, Zoe.
Thanks, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The city of Detroit and Wayne County are making concerted efforts to tackle two big problems, lack of money and blight. They're zeroing in on abandoned houses and on homes where owners have fallen behind on taxes, pay up or face foreclosure. The foreclosed homes are being offered to those who fix them up, keep them up, and pay taxes. So what does all of this mean for the people who have been living in those houses? Writer Rose Hackman looked into that question for her story for The Atlantic. Its title, One-Fifth of Detroit's Population Could Lose Their Homes. Rose Hackman is with us now. Rose, describe the process that's happening as the city and Wayne County identify those homes and then take action.
Well, it's a very long process. So what happens is, if you are a property owner in Detroit and do not pay your taxes for 1 year, your debt is transferred over to Wayne County that then monitors you for the next 2 years. And if you are found to not pay your property taxes for 3 years straight, you are eligible for tax foreclosure. And because in Detroit, it seems, we have a lot of people who are either falling behind on property taxes or not paying at all, that means that you have a lot of properties that are either going through the tax foreclosure process or threatened with tax foreclosure. We're talking about tens of thousands.
And I know that it's such a massive concern that it's hard to get fixed numbers, isn't it, as you try to figure out how many homes are we talking about or potentially how many people are we talking about.
Right, right. So this last year, 52,000 properties originally were served in the Wayne County area with tax foreclosure notices. 24,000 of those only ended up being foreclosed on last April 1st, 2014. That means that around 28,000 properties and property owners either got on payment plans or paid their taxes, and you get left with these 24,000 properties who are behind. 22,000 are in Detroit. And then there is this big idea that Detroit is a largely abandoned city, or there are a lot of abandoned properties in Detroit. So the next problem is figuring out how many of these properties are actually occupied. And the estimate that I was given by Loveland Technologies was around 10,000 properties are occupied. Again, in Detroit, it's quite difficult to know exactly whether that's an exact figure, because you might have people living inside houses that are boarded up.
And that 2.74 people per household, which is what the Census Bureau tells us, is Detroit's population. So you're looking at possibly this year's foreclosures could oust about 27,000 Detroiters. But
right.
Then knowing that there are even more homes that are kind of in the pipeline, ultimately the total possible evictions, you write to us, could be 142,000. And in a city with fewer than 700,000 residents, that's pretty sizable. But now you bring us an example of what this looks and feels like at the ground level. Tell us a little about Yvonne Brown.
Yvonne Brown is a pretty heartbreaking story. And so I knocked on her door because when I first saw it, it had Halloween decorations outside. So it was very much a lived-in house. she was being foreclosed on, she owed just over $8,000 in taxes. And she says she survives on around $850 a month, which is retirement and disability.
And how had she fallen so far behind?
Well, she bought the house, I think, 3 years ago, and it already had a lot of property taxes attached to it, which is one of the narratives that seem to have emerged. A lot of what I found talking to people is it's a very simple, you know, matter-of-fact thing that is they can't afford it, and they fell back for whatever reason.
And then once foreclosure happens, they go up for auction and for sometimes as low as $500.
Right. So the first part of the auction, the properties go up for the amount of taxes owed and liens owed, which can be, you know, anywhere between $8,000 and $15,000. And then the second part of the auction is when houses go up for $500 at a starting bid, which is the administrative fee.
And that basically clears the table of the previous debt. Could these owners pay the $500 if they knew enough to do it?
Absolutely. If they were told or if they know about the process, they are absolutely able to buy back their properties for $500 and no more debts. The problem is, what I found is that very few people seem to know about this. There are stories that I've heard, but this is secondhand, not firsthand, of investors, you know, going around telling homeowners, mm-hmm. no, you're not allowed to buy the property. You know, I can buy it for you, for example. And then that's when you get a lot of dark stories about people buying homes for very little and then selling them back to their occupants for a huge, huge margin difference.
I'm talking with the writer from The Atlantic, Rose Hackman. Her piece looks at the efforts of the city of Detroit and Wayne County to foreclose on homes where people have fallen 3 years behind in their taxes and then sell them and bring in folks who basically can pay the taxes. And Rose is number crunching in talking to Wayne County and also to the company that has been surveying the city, is that you could see up to 142,000 Detroit residents evicted going forward with this process. Here's the question. Do you think this is a concerted, deliberate effort by the city and the county to broom away poor residents, kind of clear the ground?
You know, that would be a very cynical interpretation of what's going on. I'm not necessarily saying that at all. Is there a concerted effort? I don't think so. But I think that potentially what's going on is quite grim for poor, overwhelmingly African-American residents. And when you contextualize that within a history of overt segregation, which is not that far away and in fact continues to affect current residents through the homes that they've inherited or, you know, their own family histories, I think that's where, you know, uncomfortable questions arise.
But can anyone say that things were working for the city the way they've been going, with people falling behind in taxes, 3 years behind and no way to do it? Or maybe is there an effort to differentiate those who are trying in good faith to make a dent in the tax bill and those who are trying to scam the system?
You know, some people, I'm pretty sure, maybe could afford to pay their bills, their taxes, and are not. But I reported also actually for The Atlantic on the water shutoff crisis. And it was the same. Most people I spoke to, if they could afford to pay their bills, would have to sacrifice bills that they're paying elsewhere. So, for instance, they might have trouble putting food on the table, or they might have trouble paying their electricity bill or getting gas for the car. You're talking about a population of people who are living on, you know, very, very low incomes. So it's difficult to criminalize those choices that they are having to make and say, aha, you could pay your water bill or you could have paid your property tax because, look, when we force you to do it, you did, when they're going to be suffering in other domains. This is the big problem with Detroit moving forward. You know, how do you move forward with the people that have been a part of Detroit? You know, how do you rebuild a city with a vast proportion of the population that is poor, but that also historically, potentially through a history of segregation, has been made to be poor?
Mayor Mike Duggan has been tasked with some enormous challenges, including cleaning up blight and also trying to bring badly needed money into the depleted treasury. So this is clearly one way in this whole process. Did you try to speak with him?
I did reach out to his communications director, but did not receive any answer. I did actually also reach out to the assessor's office.
I wonder, too, could one argue that, looking at the fact that we've been kind of talking about racial themes in this, could one argue that the color that matters here isn't black or white, but it's green? that it's the money that the city so badly needs. And people are going to hear this and ask what is so wrong with trying to get people who are so many years delinquent in their taxes to pay up. And if they don't, well, then open the property up to someone who can.
Sure. I mean, I agree with that. But I think that as we focus on green and as we focus on economics, we need to also understand the choices that we're making on a human level. And that's what I'm saying. At the moment, the choices that are being made by luring in richer, predominantly whiter residents are pushing out potentially older black residents. And that is the choice that we make if we focus purely on economics, unfortunately at this moment in this country, because, you know, the socioeconomic disparities between black and white are huge. You know, it's undeniable. There are studies showing that you are born in a white family today, you are going to be six times wealthier on average than your black counterpart. And the median white family is 20 times richer than the median black family. So the economic disparities are huge.
What kind of conversation are you hoping that your piece for The Atlantic will start to percolate?
I speak to people a lot privately. I've been living in the city for a year now. And I feel like in private, there are a lot of conversations that include history and include uncomfortable conversations about history in this city. And, you know, frankly, in the United States and the world, I'm English, you know, we have a terrible history of colonialism. And I feel that in the public domain, that is something that's been lacking. There is a complete discomfort with talking about these kinds of issues that unfortunately continue to affect our daily lives and our daily choices and our policy choices, potentially.
Rose Hackman's piece, One-Fifth of Detroit's Population Could Lose Their Homes, can be found in The Atlantic, which you can find at theatlantic.com. Rose, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When you think about music from Detroit, you probably think Motown, electronic, maybe some jazz. Lac La Belle is an acoustic duo bringing music of Appalachia and early Americana to the Motor City. Stateside's Emily Fox sat down with the duo to talk about their latest album.
Skip that last train going out. Ain't no way. Carry me home. Drove 1,000 spikes through steel. Rail stretching. Miles of land.
That's Nick Chalet singing there. He and Jenny Nags are the musical duo behind Lac La Belle, and they're a couple, by the way. They have a new album out called A Friend Too Long that you can hear at a CD release show that the band is hosting this Saturday in Detroit. Jenny and Nick, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
So what inspired this album? Would you say that there's an overall theme to A Friend Too Long?
Yeah, I think that what we tried to do was work with characters and try to draw a little bit away from ourselves. That was my goal, at least. And I think that it was successful.
Now, when I hear your music, it takes me outside of Michigan and to a different era. And I know you both studied traditional music in Southern Appalachia. But considering you both grew up in Michigan and now live in Detroit, does Michigan or Detroit ever inspire your music?
It does have its place in our music. This record, because we were working more with characters outside ourselves, I think that we also took on some visual ideas that were connecting to those characters. Although in the past we have used more Detroit-focused ideas with our songs, like on our previous record we have some songs that are specifically about Detroit. This record, it's more about these stories and their kind of universal ideas. And sometimes the landscapes that we describe in our music are not just an actual place, it's more of an idea. Like there's a song, Clarion, where I describe the desert. It's not really necessarily about being in the desert, it's about that feeling, that sparse feeling, loneliness, hopelessness.
Dry sand beneath my feet. The desert walks with me. Divine plan for me, just endless yearning. The night was cold and dim, and I was wrought within. No divine plan for me, just endless yearning.
I was reading a press release about your album, and it says, quote,
Perhaps one could say Detroit is a contemporary flagship American city, a pressure cooker of sorts. It signifies economic collapse and decay, giving birth to a new artistic renaissance. Now, this is not the first time I've heard something like that, but I'm curious to see what you have to say about that comment.
Yeah, Detroit is a very interesting place, we all know, and it's changed so much in the last couple of years. It's hard to really put into words if you're a resident or if you've been a long-time resident. I think that the idea that there is a new art renaissance in Detroit is maybe not quite accurate. I think that there's just always been a very, very thick vein of art and culture running through the city. And now there's other things happening that are drawing a little bit more attention to what's already been happening there. And I think that some of us are a little bit more sensitive to it than others, but I think that the thing that's important is to always remember going forward that the city has been really consistent in a lot of ways that are positive and creative, and we want to make sure that it stays like that as Detroiters.
Mm-hmm. Through all of the city struggles, I see a strong thread of the artist community holding on through these tough times, and that is what has kept the city together. And I think that's also what has made the city really desirable for some people now to see the city as someplace they could live. I mean, they're basically seeing what has always been there. It's just in the media a lot more.
And tell me about your guys' involvement in the musical community within Detroit.
Well, I mean, I've been active in the city for over 20 years. I mean, I've never moved away, and I've been, you know, working with a lot of different groups and over the years, and had a lot of solo projects that I've been involved with, and we've developed relationships with venue owners and gallery owners and different types of spaces that we've liked to work with and do our events. I mean, the event on Saturday is a good example of you know, a new space that we wanted to try to have like a new event at, to draw more attention to this particular space and also to kind of bring people into that community. And that's been something that's been relatively easy over the years in Detroit, because there's never been a lack of people trying to do new and creative spaces and opening new galleries. And for lack of a better term, there's always been a real DIY kind of thing when it comes to the art community and the music community. And we've always tried to, you know, be a part of that.
And by the way, Lock LaBelle's CD release show will be held at Holding House in Detroit Saturday evening. It's a new artist-run workspace just west of Corktown. Now, Jenny and Nick, you wrote your latest album, A Friend Too Long, in a cabin in the Upper Peninsula. And later, when you were ready to record your album in your home in Detroit, last winter's polar vortex hit.
Yeah, that was
very good. Exciting.
Yeah, that was good and bad. You know, like, we flew a really good friend of mine, old tour buddy, who's an engineer and musician. He lives out in Philadelphia. And so we flew him in to do the engineering. We wanted to do it in the house.
In Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a nice space. We have a good space for it. And we also just wanted that experience of being kind of secluded. And we didn't know, or shut in, I guess. We didn't realize how shut in we would be. Because it really, the morning that Eric flew in was the day that it started. And, you know, we had... Even though we live in a beautiful historic neighborhood in the city, we still don't get plowed. And so we were really literally stuck for a few days in the house, and I don't think Jenny left for 2 weeks, to be honest with you.
I left once to get a space heater from a neighbor because our pipe had froze.
But it was good. It was great to actually have that, you know, because we were able to just, there was no option. There was, you know, I think Eric and I left to dig a couple people out once or twice, but we were just in there, and we kept our head down. And we
very
just,
focused.
Yeah, and we were very organized about it, so it was good. And now we have this connection to the record in the house, and I think that it's a little bit more special.
Well, I've been speaking with Jenny Nags and Nick Chalais of Lac LaBelle. They have a new album out called A Friend Too Long, and they are hosting a CD release show this Saturday in Detroit. More information on the album and the release show can be found at laclabellemusic.com. Jenny and Nick, congrats on your new album, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan will send the same number of Democrats and Republicans to Washington. 9 Republicans and 5 Democrats will go from Michigan to the U.S. House. New congressional faces include Republicans David Trott, Mike Bishop, and John Molinar, and Democrats Brenda Lawrence and my next guest, Debbie Dingell. Welcome.
It is great to be with you.
Well, you are taking over the seat that your husband is retiring from, the 12th. And, of course, we know he's the longest-serving House member, Dean of the House, John Dingell. But now it is your turn to serve the 12th. What do you think the first issue is that you want to focus on once you're sworn in?
Well, one of the first things that I want to do is to work with my other colleagues in the Michigan delegation and help define what a Michigan agenda is and what are the priorities for the state. And that hopefully we can all work together to try to do what we need to do for the state. That would be one of the first things, hope that we have regular bipartisan meetings of the delegation. And then the issues that we all care about. I don't care if Republican or Democrat. Manufacturing, creating jobs, the auto industry. How do you ensure that every child in this state has access to quality, affordable education from the time that they are born through the higher ed system? We have differences on how one approaches healthcare issues, but I believe that if you are born in America, you should not have to worry about whether you can afford to go to the doctor or whether you can afford your medicine. So is the Affordable Act care perfect? No, but it's come a long way. Is there a way to find common ground to fix that bill, but to make sure that everybody who needs healthcare has access to it?
But knowing that you will be in the minority in the House, how will you work with Republicans? I mean, it is so great to hear talk of bipartisanship, but how do you really do that?
Well, you do what I always do. I mean, that was the theme of my campaign, that I wasn't going to Washington to fight with people. I was going to Washington to work with people. You know, Candace Miller and I have been friends for a long time. We've talked about working together on a number of things. I saw David Trott this morning, and I said, David, could we do some things like host roundtables with some of the industries from this area and just listen and have people see us doing things in a bipartisan way? And he said, Debbie, I want you to know that I was telling people that during the campaign. I had the same thought. So, you know, you do it in very incremental steps. You build relationships. You trust each other. How do you work together for what we need to do for this state?
Well, as I mentioned, you are one of 5 new members of Congress from Michigan, and there has been much talk about the level of seniority that's leaving Michigan's congressional delegation after this year. Do you have concerns about that going to Washington?
Look, we do need to be concerned about the wisdom and the knowledge and the experience of 4 incredible men. Every last one of them, Republican and Democrat, have been close friends. And it is going to leave a huge void in this delegation and what they've delivered to the state of Michigan. And in addition to that, none of them have been partisan. Senator Levin and John Dingell have been 2 wise men who have brought people together for decades. David Camp wanted to do a complete overhaul of the tax system and worked very closely with Max Baucus. And Mike Rogers, as chair of the Intelligence Committee, understands that there is no room in this country for anybody to be partisan when it comes to national security. So these are, I know I can't fill the shoes of the man that I'm replacing. I know how big they are. I'm going to be Debbie Dingell. And I think all of us is going to have to be each our own person and work hard to try to do some of what they did deliver for the state. But quite frankly, with those giants leaving, we all have to work together so that we can come up with solutions to try to get what they were able to get.
Through the campaign, as you met with voters, what did you hear from them that you're going to take with you to Washington?
You know, I heard a lot of different things. I said to people I was in a giant job interview, and I met with hundreds of groups of people throughout the district wanting to talk about different issues. You know, you heard some common themes, and you'd hear things that were surprising you. I mean, the students really want more financial literacy when they're in grade school and high school so that they understand that they're incurring debt. I found that to be one of the most interesting things, or how they felt about Common Core and all of the debate that we've been having about it. But I also heard people say, we're tired of the fighting. We want our roads fixed. The infrastructure needs to be fixed. They're tired of all the reasons everybody's fighting. And, I mean, business wants immigration reform because they don't have enough people to fill some of the jobs that are here. One of the messages I heard loud and clear is, can't you find a way to work together to start solving some of our problems?
Democrat Debbie Dingell, Congresswoman-elect of Michigan's 12th Congressional District. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, and I hope everybody has a great day after the election.
Particularly in the final weeks of the campaign, we kept hearing poll results predicting a dead heat between Governor Rick Snyder and Democrat Mark Schauer. In the end, it was Snyder over Schauer, 51% to 47%. How do pollsters view their track record? Bernie Porn is with us. He's president of Epic MRA in Lansing. A late night for a lot of people, but sounding pretty energized, Bernie.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. And actually, looking at our poll, our last poll had it 45 to 43, Governor Snyder over Mark Schauer. And at that time, there was a momentum from our previous poll for Mark Schauer. He was, gaining on Governor Snyder. And then after our poll, the Republican Governors Association started running negative ads against Schauer. And I think that that blunted the momentum that he had. And when you look at the results, and just a few minutes ago I was able to look at the State Board of Ed and the Education Post, and last night it appeared as though the Republicans were going to sweep those Education Posts, but that did not happen at all. As a matter of fact, the Democrats won State Board, and I think they won all of the other Education Posts, which would suggest that Lon Johnson may have gotten a bad rap in terms of not being able to turn out Democrats statewide, because winning those Education Posts is an indication that the party base for Democrats did turn out. And as a matter of fact, when you perform my little calculation of the party base for those Education Posts as a proportion of the total vote for governor, you end up with a 42% Dem base, 39% Republican base, and 18% independent. And usually in our poll, the party base has come out to 42% Democrat, 38% or 39% Republican, with about 18% independent. However, those people who vote at the top of the ballot, and they don't vote just based on the party queue, because the folks that vote for those Education Posts, they don't know who those candidates are. The folks voting at the top of the ticket and not voting down there, they're independent voters. And when you do the calculations, Governor Snyder got 72% of the drop-off independent vote. And at the same time, Gary Peters got 88% of the drop-off independent vote for U.S. Senate. It is interesting to note that when you look at the average of the state board candidates, which was about 1.2 4 million votes for state board, and then look at how many votes Terry Lynn Land got, just under 47,000 more votes than the unknown candidates for State Board of Education got.
Boy.
So that's an indication of how poorly she ran. So in looking at the polling, we had it down by 2. It ended up winning by 4. We feel very good about how accurate the poll was, and things broke toward the end. Republicans turned out their vote almost as well as the Democrats did in terms of those party base votes. And looking at the independent vote, clearly Governor Snyder was able to appeal to the independent voters. Mark Schauer did not. And Gary Peters appealed to the independent vote. And also the Republican candidates for U.S. Congress and for state legislature, they did better among independent voters at the level voting for those respective campaigns or those offices than did Democrats. So the Democrats may feel good about how they turned out the party base, but they need to re-examine how they do among those independent voters, because clearly they did not fare as well as candidates for Congress, the governor, attorney general, secretary of state, that was clearly something that happened nationwide as well.
Bernie, are there ways that poll results can be ginned up or spun to make a race seem more exciting?
Oh, yeah, you can do that, but that's not something that should be done. You had 4 polls showing it was dead even, and ours, which was conducted a few days earlier, had the 2 points. But the Snyder campaign was able to blunt the momentum of the Schauer campaign and, I think, recapture the edge in terms of appealing to those independent voters.
Bernie, so how would you grade yourself? We're here we are, day after the election. How would you grade the performance of your polls throughout the campaign?
throughout the campaign, I'd give us at least a B, maybe even an A. And by the way, the B, that is what Nate Silver with 538 gave us as a rating. And we feel blessed that we rated a little bit better than other pollsters who compete in Michigan. I think most of them had C grades, as I recall, from Nate Silver.
Bernie Porn, president of Epic MRA in Lansing. Thanks so much for talking with us, Bernie.
You're very, very welcome. Thanks for calling.
Let's cap off today's program and take an overall look at Election Day 2014. Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry is here with us now. Jack, let's start with the governor's race. Did Mark Schauer fall short because he positioned himself as not Rick Snyder instead of I am Mark Schauer?
Well, that may have something to do with it. I was talking to a financial services person today who said that he made the case for why Snyder needed to be replaced, but he just didn't make the sale. But I think we need to say two things about Mark Schauer. He did actually very, very well given the turnout. He was only 4% short. It was 51% to 47%. Snyder is the first sitting governor in more than 50 years to do much worse his second time than his first time. And the main culprit here, as far as I can tell, Cindy, is turnout. The Democrats' operation, their whole operation, Lon Johnson, the new party chair, based everything on trying to boost turnout. And turnout, to me, at this point, looks like fewer people voted than did 4 years ago. And fewer people voted, especially in Detroit, the Detroit area. It rained all day. But I think had that not happened, this might have been a real cliffhanger.
You really think the weather made that much difference? Was it really that bad?
Well, people don't want to stand in line, especially in sort of in a lot of inner city areas. You have not enough polling places for everybody, and the idea of standing out there if you're sort of is sort of daunting, especially if you're not heavily engaged in the process. And the big mystery to me is that Lon Johnson, again, the Democratic chair, sent out almost a million absentee ballot applications. He assured people that these were coming back, that they were far ahead of where they were with absentees last time. But again, there are fewer votes. So, but you have a point, Cindy. If people were very engaged, I think in the 2008 election, when President Obama first ran, African Americans would have stood in line during a hurricane to vote for him. And it's important to say the people who did vote for Detroit, we talked a lot during the campaign about everything Snyder had done for Detroit. It didn't show up in the voting. He got only 7% of the vote in Detroit. But there weren't enough votes to overcome his lead in most places elsewhere.
It's interesting that this happened, Jack, with Snyder really doing his usual thing, steering clear of that all-out campaigning and politicking that you know he doesn't really care for. And it seems, based on what you're saying about his numbers as he's reelected, Schauer could have had a chance. It seemed that the door was cracked open.
Well, while Snyder may have steered clear of sort of flamboyant campaigning, he and his surrogates and the sort of dark money forces that involve more and more of our campaigns spent millions and millions of dollars on his behalf. There was a very question when you signed on to the Detroit Free Press's website for the last 2 days, a Snyder ad popped up saying how bad Schauer was. I don't know whether it's the Snyder forces or some other forces placed that ad, so they were out there. But yes, it was never very clear what Mark Schauer would do or how he would pay for the things he said he would do, abolishing the pension tax, for example, how he would make up the revenue for that. He said he'd fix the roads, but never gave any kind of explanation of how he would pay to fix the roads. And this may have been sort of telling. I was surprised a little bit. Oakland County, where his running mate, Lisa Brown, is a very popular county clerk, Oakland County went much more heavily for Snyder than I expected it to, and so did Macomb County, and there was a lot of deficit to make up. Schauer, indeed, unlike Bernero, the candidate 4 years ago, won the outstate cities, won Saginaw and Bay City and Flint and Muskegon and a good chunk of the Upper Peninsula, but there just weren't enough votes there.
Let's talk about the Senate race. Was the door open for a better Republican candidate than Terry Lynn Land to get in there and grab Carl Levin's seat?
At the risk of sounding catty, it would be hard to imagine a worse Republican candidate than Terry Lynn Land. Greg McNeely, a top Republican consultant, described her candidacy on election night in terms I can't say on the radio. But Michigan is a very Democratic state in terms of statewide elections. The Republicans have won one U.S. Senate election in 43 years. and it's not clear they're going to win another one anytime soon, since we tend to re-elect incumbent senators. The only one they ever won was the open seat in the landslide Republican victory of 1994, 20 years ago. And, of course, Michigan now is a very blue state in presidential elections. We weren't on the World Wide Web the last time Republicans won this state. But another candidate, especially in this year, it would be very interesting to speculate, what if Mike Rogers had run, the congressman from Lansing? What if Governor Snyder had decided to go for the Senate rather than run for governor? We won't know, but what we do know is that the Republican Party, essentially, before the election was out, sort of abandoned Terry Lynn Land. And had this not been a totally Republican year, she probably would have done even worse than the 41% of the vote she got.
Let's talk about the State House and the State Senate, still under GOP control. But, boy, based on some of the new faces elected to the State House, it's going to be much farther to the right. What were voters saying here?
I think that voters were just repudiating the Democrats. And this is a bit of a surprise to me. I didn't really think that Democrats would take the House. Republicans had a 59-51 advantage. I didn't see Republicans winning four seats. But it's more than that. Some of the moderate Republicans are gone, or more moderate Republicans because of term limits. You have three of the most shrill Tea Party people in the state being elected to the Michigan legislature. Republicans did something that I can tell you even they didn't imagine. They gained the seat in the state Senate. They thought they might lose one or two. The Democrats originally were hoping to gain four. There are now only 11 Democrats in the Michigan state Senate. You could pack them all in a van. The Michigan Senate, after the next 4 years, will have been in Republican hands solid for 35 years, and I'm not at all convinced that I'll live to see a day when Democrats hold the Michigan Senate again. So with that dynamic, it makes it impossible or very unlikely for, even if there were a Democratic governor, for them to do anything.
Well, let's talk about what kind of challenges does a term-limited moderate Republican like Rick Snyder face with this lot? Who's going to be driving the bus and setting the agenda?
Well, that's a very good question. Governor Snyder found out in his first term that he could get the legislature to do things they wanted to do. They were kind of like a six-week-old puppy. They're very happy to run to you when you hold out food, but if you want to take them for a walk or housebreak them, they don't do it. And the ominous thing for me is that the governor absolutely, totally failed to get members of his own party to pass bills calling for new revenue to fix the roads. This new lot is going to be less inclined to do that, as far as I can tell. And if we're ever going to get the roads fixed, it's going to have to be done in the lame duck session that's going to happen in November and December. But there's something else. I can tell you what Democrats are afraid of in the lame duck session. They're afraid an attempt will be made to change the Electoral College to give Republicans an unfair advantage there, too. So it's going to be a very interesting session.
Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry. As always, thank you so much, Jack.
My pleasure.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.